I'm Rick Ganley. This is NHPR News. It's 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. There's so much romanticism surrounding the American Revolution, especially as it unfolded in Massachusetts. There's the Boston Tea Party, the Midnight Ride of Paul Revere, and of course, the shot heard round the world. Many New Englanders have heard these tales since they were kids and know by heart the names of our region's famous patriots, notables like John Hancock or Samuel Adams. And yet, our guest today says we really only know part of the story, and a pretty small part at that. We're talking this hour with award-winning author and historian Nathaniel Philbrick. In his new book, Bunker Hill, Philbrick offers a far more complicated tale of pre-revolutionary Boston that includes less familiar personalities. The brash young doctor Joseph Warren, who basically ran the revolution while bigwigs like Adams and Hancock were in Philadelphia. The grizzled General Israel Putnam, known as Old Putt and beloved by his soldiers. The doctor Benjamin Church, who turned out to be a bigger traitor than Benedict Arnold. And the conflicted Thomas Gage, the second to last royal governor of Massachusetts, married to a New Jersey woman, and at first somewhat sympathetic toward the Americans. Today in The Exchange, the fascinating backstory of Bunker Hill by Nathaniel Philbrick. Let's get your questions into the Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or you can post a comment on our Facebook page. And Nathaniel Philbrick, welcome back. It's great to have you.
Oh, it's great to be back.
Well, when learning about the war as kids, you know, it's all presented as clear-cut battles and black-and-white decisions. But you write, Nathaniel, that there's a lot of messiness and confusion to the revolution and to our understanding of it. Let's untangle some of that. First of all, you write that even by the early to mid-1770s, so, you know, almost on the brink of war, not everybody in Boston was a red-blooded patriot. How divided were they, Nathaniel?
Yeah, you know, that there was a division right across the entire population of Boston. Boston was about 15,000 people, and you had brothers who one would be a loyalist saying, you know, I'm a merchant and London is my marketplace. I treasure our bonds to the mother country. And then you had another brother who was a patriot who said, you know, I don't want to pay these taxes. I want to go the other way. And so then there was another group, the largest perhaps, that really didn't care about these issues and just wanted life to remain the way it had always been, because life was pretty good in the colonies in the 1770s.
So the divisions entered families. I mean, we all hear about with the Civil War, but you're saying with the Revolutionary War as well.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the families, the Malcolm family, Daniel Malcolm was a foremost patriot. During the Stamp Act, he was doing everything he could to put down the British government, and he died early, and his gravestone would eventually be used for target practice by the British regulars who occupied Boston during the Revolution. His brother, John Malcolm, was a customs official and was obviously a loyalist and would actually be tarred and feathered the month after the Boston Tea Party. And so you have two brothers on, you know, showing on completely opposite sides of the coming revolution.
A couple things that I want to pick up on, Nathaniel. You've mentioned already twice the role of commerce in this whole move towards revolution. Talk about that a little bit more and how some commercial interests were very uninterested in fomenting war with Britain, whereas others really wanted to stick it to England.
Yeah, well, you know, we think of the revolution as this kind of ideologically driven event.
Right.
When in reality, it came down to people's pocketbook. And there were merchants who relied on their relationship with London to keep things going. And then there was another group of merchants who had developed a smuggling trade, particularly when it related to tea. And they would smuggle illegal, cheap Dutch tea in from the Caribbean. And this is how they made their money. And then when the Tea Act was instituted in 1773, lowering the price of British tea, they were angry because this meant that their smuggled tea was no longer the cheapest tea in town. And so, you know, rather than necessarily seeing this as a taxation without representation, they were mainly driven by their own bottom line. And so, you know, there was an interesting complex matrix of motivation motivations when it came to the growing tensions that would become the revolution.
Yeah, and I love that story about the Boston Tea Party, because you're right, it has turned into this sort of epic legend of what we're all about as a people. And yet you say it was because these merchants didn't want their cheap Dutch tea undercut by a lower price on British tea. You write that, you know, you'd think the Bostonians would have been happy, right? I mean, cheaper tea.
Yeah, I mean, this was a windfall for the consumer, as we would say today. And people could have get their tea cheaper. The British government had not smartly included a very minimal tax in this, and so that the merchants who relied, whose business was based on smuggling tea, obviously embraced the ideological reasons for opposing the act, when, you know, they had different concerns probably also contributing to their point of view. And, you know, the reality of it was that the colonists in the 1770s were the freest, least taxed people in the British Empire. And the British Empire was at a point where they were terribly in debt after the French and Indian War, which had fought largely on behalf of the colonies. And so they were trying to get the colonies to contribute to their upkeep in the empire. They didn't see it as a tyranny type thing. They saw it just as making economic sense. Well, the colonists wanted it to be the way it always been, something known as salutary neglect, where they were pretty much left to do it on their own. And so the colonists were really, in many ways, motivated by a profoundly conservative impulse. They just leave it alone, keep it the way it was. And you know, the tensions would mount, and it would, of course, explode into what we now call the American Revolution.
Well, and that's not the narrative that we learn, at least in those high school history books. You know, what you just said, Nathaniel, that the colonists were actually the freest, least taxed people in the British Empire. That is not what we learn. How did that sort of narrative get changed?
Well, you know, I think that what happened was that the narrative assumed what would eventually happen was the goal in the beginning, and that was a war of independence and independence for America. And that's not how it began. No one was talking about independence. Even radicals such as Samuel Adams looked to the mother country as home. I mean, that's how they referred to England. It was all about issues of representation. And so if you assume that independence was the point of view at the, you know, from the beginning, you can say this was a revolution to create a new nation. In fact, it was a the tensions were to keep it the way it had always been, and it was as Britain responded in an increasingly ham-fisted way to the violence in New England that people began to get polarized, and people began to get pushed into the various corners, and ultimately it would explode in revolution.
Yeah, it's interesting. One person who reviewed this book sort of framed it, and you're touching on this, Nathaniel, as a battle of public relations. And time and time again, you say that the Brits just kind of muffed it, you know, in terms of working things out with the Americans. And this person's review said, and I think you'd agree, the Patriots did a very good job with public relations, you know, the Boston Massacre and the Tea Party and so forth. Talk about that a little bit, Nathaniel.
Well, you know, it really does come down to how you get the information out and
right.
how you get the word out. And Samuel Adams, no one was the architect of this revolution. There was no one person who had this completely under their control, but he was a key figure. And one of the moves he made very early on in 1772 was to create the Boston Committee of Correspondence. And this was a 21-member committee that would compose open letters that were then sent to all the towns throughout Massachusetts. And this was when Massachusetts included what we now call Maine, 250 towns. And these letters discussed the issues of the day. Does Parliament have sovereignty over us? Or is our general court the one that we should be looking to? These kinds of issues. And these letters were then read in town meetings. And, you know, up until this point, town meetings had been where people discussed very local issues like bridge repair and widening roads. But now, with the Boston Committee of Correspondence, these letters were turning the town meetings into chat rooms about the issues of the day. And so they were radicalizing these what were known as country towns. And these towns would then create their own committees of correspondence, send responses back to Boston, and you got this whole independent communication network going on that allowed the revolutionary fervor to build completely unchained from the royal government. And so the royal governor, Thomas Hutchinson, at this time, was just taken aback as he watched everything suddenly accelerate as Samuel Adams and the committee created this whole new way of communicating that really changed the way things were happening throughout the colony.
Well, and that raises another big theme in this book that, again, I had not realized. Country versus city. Give us some of the differences there, Nathaniel.
Yeah. Well, you know, Boston was the city, 15,000 people. It was an island, basically. Bore no resemblance to what Boston is today. It was this an island connected by a thin neck of land to Roxbury, dominated by three hills of mountainous proportions, and it was a very big-time port, and so it was all oriented towards the ocean. But it got it got many of its supplies and agricultural products from the country towns. And these towns were very different from Boston in that they were mainly farmers, and they were it was family bonds that went back to the very beginning, and so it was a very two different sides to the identity, really, of New England. And in the beginning, Boston was the center of patriot defiance. It was where these issues were bubbling up. This is where riots were unfolding and the Boston Massacre and this kind of thing was happening. It was with the creation of the Committee of Correspondence that suddenly there was all of that fervor was given away to transmit itself to these towns. And the way these town people interpreted it was that their forefathers had been fighting for their freedoms when it came to the various French and Indian wars that they had been fighting for more than a century. Now they were still prepared to fight for their freedoms if it was against the British.
Well, and French and Indian wars definitely are part of this story, too, because they helped train some of the revolutionaries and so forth. We will talk a lot more after a short break. Start taking your calls, too, at 1-800-892-6477.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. Looking for something to do this weekend? Well, look no further than your NHPR member card. With it, you can take advantage of our August benefit of the month, 2-for-1 discount at the Silver Center for the Arts in Plymouth. For more about the member card and the doors it opens for you, visit nhpr.org. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and support also comes to us from Fairfield's Cadillac and Keene, offering Cadillac and other fine automobiles in central New England for 109 years, online at keenecadillac.com. From the Currier Museum of Art in Manchester, presenting visual dispatches from the Vietnam War, featuring photographs that moved a generation, details at courier.org. And Monadnock Music presenting pianist Anthony DeMare, performing concert works based on musicals by Stephen Sondheim, Saturday, August 10th at 3 p.m. at the Peterborough Townhouse. MonadnockMusic.org. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, historian Nathaniel Philbrick on his new book, Bunker Hill, A City, A Siege, A Revolution. It's a revealing look at pre-revolutionary Boston and the events that led up to war. We invite you to join us with your questions and comments about this. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org, or you can post a comment on our Facebook page. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Nathaniel Philbrick's earlier books include In the Heart of the Sea, Mayflower, and The Last Stand. And Nathaniel, I wanted to just ask you very quickly about that book, Mayflower, and I think that was the last time we talked when that book came out. You have said that this book, Bunker Hill, is a continuation of Mayflower. But there's a lot of years separating the Voyage of the Mayflower and Bunker Hill. So make the connection there for us, Nathaniel.
Right. Well, Mayflower begins, obviously, with the voyage that with which the Pilgrims arrived in the New World, but it ends 55 years later with the terrible native English conflict known as King Philip's War, which was fought in 1675-76. And, you know, precisely 100 years before the revolution would unfold in America. And it was while finishing Mayflower that I realized, wow, you know, there's a lot of unfinished business in the 17th century that will inform what's going to happen with the revolution. And what's interesting is in the midst of King Philip's War, in which a third of the English towns throughout New England were burned and abandoned. I mean, it was just a terrible conflict. The Massachusetts Governor Leverett said to an envoy from the king that the king could grant his colonists more liberties if he wanted, but didn't he understand that the general court had sovereignty over anything the parliament might say? And what he was saying was exactly what his great-grandchildren would be saying 100 years later. These people were descended from Puritans who had come over in the 1630s to get away from the British government so that they could worship the way they wanted to, free from the king and his bishops. And so there was a sense of autonomy, of we are here to go our own way from the very beginning. And so in Bunker Hill, I wanted to explore how those sort of ancient tribal points of view informed the colonists when it came to the very different Enlightenment world of the 18th century.
And that was a big deal, right, to sort of say, look, our local legislature, the general court, which we still call it here in New Hampshire, has precedence over you, King, and the parliament.
Yeah, it really was. And, you know, and it's interesting, because of things like the town meeting, where people had an ability to have input and where decisions came about through consensus, New Englanders had just a different attitude towards things, where they were used to having a voice and a very direct voice. In England, that kind of situation didn't exist. And so issues of representation, they felt that they were being represented, even though it was very indirect. So when British authorities looked to America, they couldn't understand what the New Englanders were saying. What do you mean you don't have representation? You have as much representation as anybody in England. It was just that Americans had developed a different sense of how their voice should influence the way decisions were being made.
Okay, so square that feeling that is, you know, goes way, way back, that we are independent, we make our own way, and with the sentiment that you describe in Bunker Hill, that even some of those who might have called themselves patriots were still hoping for some kind of reconciliation with England pretty late in the game. So kind of tie that together, because it almost seems in conflict.
It does. And the patriots themselves were in conflict. Many of the foremost patriot leaders, you see them suffering psychological issues. John Adams would have a breakdown in the midst of all this, because what they were, if you looked at it logically, if you looked at what the patriots were saying, and British Governor Thomas Hutchinson pointed this out, you're saying independence, because if you're saying we have sovereignty over ourselves, you're saying we want to be independent. But the New Englanders said, no, that's not what we want. It's an issue of representation. And it was as Britain responded in an increasingly militant way to what was happening in Massachusetts that the New Englanders got forced into saying, whoa, you know, we disagree and we want to go our own way. Initially, the patriots claimed our issues are not with the king. We are loyal to King George. It's his parliament that we object to. And so even after soldiers arrive in Boston, even after Lexington and Concord, even after the Battle of Bunker Hill, New Englanders were pledging loyalty to King George. They were saying it was the parliament, the ministerial soldiers that they were fighting against. And so the British soldiers said, what do you mean? You know, this makes no logical sense. But this was the fiction the patriots clung to, because it was so hard for them to admit that what they were pushing for would ultimately result in independence. And I think this ambivalence that was at the heart of the revolutionary movement has been missed. It was a very difficult thing for New Englanders to make that leap into independence. And they only did it very begrudgingly, and after push came to shove. And so it's a interesting element to the revolution that I think is very revealing to how tortured and difficult it was for all concerned.
Yeah, it really is revealing to hear about even someone like John Adams. I mean, talk about a patriot, hearing about how long he was conflicted. So what did finally put them over the edge, Nathaniel? Was there, you know, sort of one aha moment, or was it cumulative, or what?
You know, I call my book Bunker Hill because the Battle of Bunker Hill, it's not necessarily the focal point of my book, but it's the turning point. It's where, after the shot heard around the world, those were skirmishes. Bunker Hill was a battle. It was two armies meeting each other. And it was clear after this that this was not just a revolution. It was now a war. And as this war developed, with the arrival of George Washington becoming the new commander of what become the Continental Army, New Englanders and colonists throughout the 13 colonies began to realize that with the king saying, because the king that fall in 1775 would say, look, do not quit saying you're loyal to me when you are doing all of this. And he basically called them out and said, what you're doing is you know, you've rebelled. This is a war of independence. And he sort of said that, and begrudgingly the colonists said, yeah, maybe you're right. And it was Thomas Paine's Common Sense that came out early in 1776 that sort of laid it all out and said, look, you know, this is the truth. This is where we are. And soon after, in the summer of 1776, of course, would be the signing of the Declaration of Independence. But it was a very difficult step for the colonists to make, because they were English. They saw themselves as you know, part of the empire, and to make this break was traumatic, to say the least.
I've got an email here that I want to share with you, too, related to something you just said. I also want to invite you to join us with your questions and comments for author Nathaniel Philbrick. The new book is called Bunker Hill, A City, A Siege, A Revolution. We invite your questions and comments about some of the backstory to these pre-revolutionary times in New England. And as Mr. Philbrick is telling us, there are some aspects of the revolution that we've learned that are more complicated than what we heard about in high school. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. Here's an email from Jack in Manchester who says, how accurate is the Bill of Particulars, charges of tyranny, against the British King in the Declaration of Independence? Jack, thanks for the email. Go ahead, Nathaniel.
Yeah, well, you know, it was convenient for the Patriots to refer to British tyranny. Because that's how it was perceived from this side, that it was the British were knuckling down and taking. But what was interesting is that the Patriots, it was because the Britain had allowed them to maintain their English liberties that gave them the opportunity to create this revolution. One of the characters I had great sympathy for was Royal Governor Thomas Gage. Here he arrived on the scene to institute the Port Act, to shut down Boston as a commercial entity, and stop the political upheaval. And yet he respected the Patriots' English liberties, and that's why they were able to organize this revolution. And so the great irony is it was Britain's lack of tyranny that enabled this revolution to unfold. And so, you know, what is described in the Declaration of Independence was believed by the Patriots and all that, but once again, it's a matter of perspective. If you were on the British side, you'd say, look, these are the least taxed people on earth. All we're asking for them to do is to pay for their upkeep. And it's, you know, they object to how we're asking them to do that. Let's work it out. What happened was no one was able to work it out as violence escalated and both sides overreacted. No one wanted this war. This was not anything anyone wanted. In fact, each side was trying to call the other's bluff. And for the first time, Britain refused to back down. in all the other instances leading up to this, they would always withdraw the onerous legislation and start all over again. But it didn't happen this time, and a revolution resulted.
No one wanted this war. That's a pretty big statement, Nathaniel.
Right. Oh, this was the last thing anybody wanted. And
even people like John Hancock and, you know, Paul Revere.
Yeah, not in the beginning. They were all banking. You could say that the revolution was a gross miscalculation on both sides, everyone expected the other to back down. And in the winter of 1775, people could not believe they were getting to this point. How did we get here? And many of the people who had been undecided would have never gone down that Patriot Road if they had known it was going to lead to this. And, you know, it's very interesting. And once things happen, you have no choice. You just to keep going. And so you see how what begins as a squabble that people are hopeful will get negotiated in some way leads to violence. And as the crisis escalates, it moves in directions that nobody anticipated and becomes the War of Independence that creates our nation. And so it's very interesting to see how organically and it evolved in unexpected ways.
You know, one quick fact point that I have to ask you about, because I know I'm going to get emails or calls about it. Bunker Hill actually is misnamed, right? Bunker Hill versus Breed's Hill. Help me out with that.
Right. The Battle of Bunker Hill was fought on the Charlestown Peninsula, just across Boston Harbor from Boston. And it was called the Battle of Bunker Hill, and partly because the original intention on the Patriots was to build a fort on Bunker Hill, which is a large hill on the northern side of the peninsula. Instead, for reasons that are unclear to this day, William Prescott and 1,000 Patriots built their earthen redoubt on the night of June 16, 1775, on what's now known as Breed's Hill, a half mile to the south, right in the figurative face of the British. And that's what instigated what became the Battle of Bunker Hill. It occurred actually on Breed's Hill. And so today, if you go to Charlestown and you go to the Bunker Hill Monument, you'll look at this beautiful monument that is on Breed's Hill. And in fact, there is a little sign that says Breed's Hill. And so it's confusing to this day. Part of the problem was it wasn't commonly known as Breed's Hill then. It was later sort of became known as Breed's Hill, and this all led to the confusion. So it's, some people say, well, why don't we call it the Battle of Breed's Hill? It's Bunker Hill. We'll just stick with it.
Well, if you'd called the book Breed's Hill, nobody would buy it,
because
people would say, I never heard of that. Again, the name of the book is Bunker Hill, A City, A Siege, A Revolution. The author is Nathaniel Philbrick. It takes a close look at the many characters and events in pre-revolutionary Boston and the outlying towns. The number for you to join us with your questions and comments is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. I want to ask you, Nathaniel, about some of the characters that are described in this book. You already mentioned Thomas Gage, the conflicted royal governor, married to a New Jersey woman, sympathetic to the Americans. Another huge character in this book is Dr. Joseph Warren. Now, people who've studied the Revolution have probably heard of him, but I haven't. Tell us who he was, why he was so important.
Yeah, he was a 33-year-old doctor, a widower with four kids between the ages of 2 and 8, one of the foremost doctors in Boston. And for the last 10 years, he had sort of studied under Samuel Adams when it came to the patriot rhetoric of the day. He was very eloquent. Kind of a swashbuckling personality, and when things began to unfold in the fall of 1774 and tensions mounted going into the spring of 1775, he emerged as the de facto leader because Samuel Adams, John Hancock, when things were happening, they tended to be either on their way or at the Continental Congress in Philadelphia. It would be Joseph Warren who would give his friend Paul Revere the orders to alert the countryside that British regulars were headed to Concord. In the days after Lexington and Concord, he would become president of the Provincial Congress of Massachusetts. He would also head the Committee of Safety, which is operated as the executive branch of the government. And he would be named a major general. And if he hadn't died during the third and last British charge of the Battle of Bunker Hill, he might very well have been one of the founding fathers we all talk about today. He was, you know, he's a fascinating guy. He could connect with people from all walks of life, possessed of tremendous energy, and also just a great writer and speaker. And so it was a true tragedy when he died. And yet, because he died, with the arrival of none other than George Washington a few weeks after the Battle of Bunker Hill, when you have such an outsized personality of that arriving, I think there's little wonder that today Joseph Warren is sort of dropped off the radar screen of history. But I think he deserves to be recognized for what he did, because if anyone was a true revolutionary in Boston, it was Joseph Warren.
Yeah, he seems to be one of those people, and correct me if I'm wrong, he seems to be one of the few maybe that was more comfortable asserting independence from England.
Yeah, I mean, he's a very interesting person to track. He was totally dedicated to the movement, and so you see his point of view change as he feels the people need to be nudged in different directions. When the country towns were getting radicalized and were threatening to push things into violence too early, he was talking very conservatively, saying, okay, let's just settle down. And then in the winter of 1775, when it seems like the revolutionary movement is languishing, he is the one who's upping the ante and stoking the fires of anger. And so, you know, he was a very interesting person to track. But reading his letters, and there are these wonderful letters between him and Samuel Adams, who was down in Philadelphia, you know, in the midst of all this chaos. And, you know, he was there on the Battle Road when the British were fighting their way from Concord back to Boston, literally house to house. He was up there and had a pin knocked out of his hair by a musket ball.
Wow.
After putting himself so squarely in harm's way. I mean, he was this kind of guy. But he was writing these letters in which they are talking about, you know, what kind of government should we have, and how our leaders need to be sanctioned by the people, not by some other higher authority. You know, these kinds of issues. And so he was right in the midst of this tremendous swirling vortex that was the revolution in Boston. And if he hadn't been there, I don't think there was a personality with the stature and just the energy to hold it all together during these 60 days between Lexington and Concord and the Battle of Bunker Hill, which were just chaotic things happening, you know, back and forth. He held it together.
Wow. Well, it really makes you wonder, one of those things, what if this person hadn't been there? So
yeah.
We will take your calls and emails after a short break. I have another email I want to share with you, Nathaniel. 1-800-892-6477. Post a comment on our Facebook page if you'd like, or email us, exchange@nhpr.org. We'll be right back.
This is NHPR 939. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the sale of the Washington Post and the future of journalism. Then, for this month's Environmental Outlook, the economic value of nature. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Rehmshire weather today, partly to mostly sunny with high temperatures mid to upper 70s, partly cloudy tonight, areas of fog after midnight, lows tonight upper 40s to mid 50s. Support for NHPR comes from UR members, and support also comes to us from Dr. Rod Burdett and Riverview Dental of Concord, offering same-day tooth replacement with mini dental implants for stable chewing and enhanced denture retention. Details at 228-1066. And Sulloway and Hollis, providing legal solutions and effective advocacy for healthcare organizations and professionals, schools and businesses throughout New Hampshire. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, historian and author Nathaniel Philbrick talks about his new book, Bunker Hill, A City, A Siege, A Revolution. It's the story of little-known but vitally important characters in the dramatic days leading up to the Revolution in New England. It also untangles some of the mythology surrounding the American War for Independence in terms of what sparked it and how ordinary people felt about it. Join us with your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477. 877. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And Nathaniel, here's an email from Brad in Francistown, who asks a question that I know you raise in the book. He says, describe the amount of slavery ownership in Boston at this time. Who among the Patriots were slave owners? Who among the Patriots were slave traders? You talk about this.
Yeah. You know, it's kind of remarkable for us to think that given the rhetoric of tyranny, liberty, that a significant number of people in the Patriot cause were slave owners, and or at least condoned it. I talk about the black poet Phyllis Wheatley, who was a Boston slave, whose poems were published to great renown. And there is a wonderful letter she wrote just as all of this is happening in the winter of 1774, sort of calling the Patriots out, saying, you know, isn't it ironic that Boston's Patriots can talk about issues of liberty and tyranny when many of them do not apply that to, African people? And it's been estimated that in the mid-1700s, one in five Boston families had slaves. We know that Joseph Warren, for example, at one point owned a young slave, and whether or not that was true at the time of the Revolution is unclear. But the point is that their rhetoric, and we can say, well, their rhetoric was one thing and their lives another. But this, the irony and the injustice of this was pointed out by many. And it adds to the complexity of this story.
Right, and impressive that she felt like she could call them out on that she was not only African-American, but a woman.
Yes, and this was actually published in a Boston paper at this time. And so, it was a voice that was being heard. And it's interesting, as this escalates into war and the provincial army is being organized, it's determined that no black slaves can serve in the army, because that would be unjust, given that they're fighting for liberty, but free blacks can. And then once Washington comes in, that gets revised, but then returns to that same language. And it was just the beginning of the issue that almost 100 years later would, of course, erupt in the Civil War. And we like to think of the Revolution as where the founding fathers made this country. Well, they just began this country, and a lot of the unfinished business of the Revolution, and remember, there was unfinished business from the 17th century, would be played across the 19th century and make the Civil War happen. And so my book is really about the beginning of America, but not the beginning and end point of the beginning. It's just the beginning of the messy business of America.
Well, and yeah. Brad, it's a great question, because also, Nathaniel, there are points during these early pre-revolutionary days where there are rumors that, the slaves are going to revolt and join the British, and, you better watch out. So.
Well, I think, one of the responses during the shot heard round the world, that day of Lexington and Concord, what happened was this great fear swept across all the towns surrounding Boston, and the fear was that the slaves that were a part of their community were now going to use this opportunity to finish what the British began. And so you have accounts of women who were left alone as their husbands were, fighting the British, gathering in houses and in fear that they were about to be attacked by this rebellion. And this is not an element of the Revolution that most of us are familiar with. And yet, and this points to the fact that there were great fears and insecurities and anxieties attached to this. This was not all a noble quest for liberty. This was something that was getting to the very dark and deep fabric of where these people had come from and where ultimately they were going.
Again, the book is Bunker Hill by Nathaniel Philbrick, A City, A Siege, A Revolution. Let's hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. Keep those emails coming, exchange@nhpr.org. And we have a call, Nathaniel, Jake in Hooksett. Go ahead, Jake, you're on the air. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, guys. It's a pleasure to speak to both of you. I'm a longtime listener and a transplanted from a small town in Pennsylvania, Schnecksville. I came up here for graduate school, so it's a pleasure to speak to both of you guys.
Go ahead, Jake.
So my question, Nathaniel, is this. Why? It's very confusing, I'm sure, to a lot of Americans that we celebrate Independence Day on July 4th. Because that's not really when we should be celebrating it. In your, I'm not sure if this is relevant, and I apologize if it's not. Why is it that we are celebrating it on the 4th if that's not the correct day?
Well, when do you think we should be celebrating it, Jake?
I think I've been told at one point we actually should be celebrating it on the 2nd.
Okay. Yes, I think I'd heard something like that, too. Thanks a lot for the call. Go ahead, Nathaniel.
Yes, I'm not an expert in this, but you're absolutely right. The dates are wrong, and you know, and it's become I wrote Mayflower, and of course the celebration of Thanksgiving is become a similar kind of encrusted mythic date, and which really bears no resemblance to when the original first Thanksgiving occurred, and it's similar to this. Hey, 4th of July, it has a ring to it. We'll go for it. I mean, my book ends with July 18, 1776, which was when the first time the Declaration of Independence was publicly read in Boston. And, which is, should be the sacred day in Boston. And, I think the significant thing is, it's sort of like the difference between Bunker Hill and Breed's Hill. Getting the precision down is not the point. Celebrating it is. And the important thing is to try to figure out what we are celebrating, because that's the important part. And the fact that let's not pat ourselves on the back, but realize that the Declaration of Independence was just the beginning of an set of ideals that it's up to us to keep trying to attain.
Yeah, it is interesting, though. July 2nd, July 4th, Breed's Hill, Bunker Hill. At some point, you just have to move on. Jake,
right.
Yeah, I appreciate the call, Jake. Thank you very much. And let's go to Richmond, where Melissa is calling in. Hi, Melissa. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange.
Hi, glad to talk to you. I've enjoyed Ms. Philbrook's previous books and look forward to reading this one. As it happens, I just started reading Revolutionary Summer by Joseph Ellis. And just this morning, I read about Joseph Warren. And Mr. Ellis says that Warren died at Bunker Hill, and then his dead body was bayoneted by several British soldiers. And then the next day, the British decapitated Warren and displayed his head on a spit. And I thought this was horrifyingly interesting, and I was wondering if Mr. Philbrook would have any comment on that, please.
Wow, Melissa, thank you.
Yeah, what's being transmitted there is a rumor that it was his body may have been bayoneted. There's no evidence of that, but his head was certainly not. He was not decapitated, because the following year, in April of 1776, after the British evacuation of Boston, his body was exhumed by his brothers, who found the head attached to the body. And it was because the head was still attached to the body that they were able to identify with certainty that it was the body of their brother, because he had had dental work performed. He had a couple of false teeth. And so that was how they identified, made sure that that was the body. So what Ellis Joseph Ellis is recounting is a rumor that was being said on the Patriot side, not necessarily an expression of what actually happened.
Wow. All right. Well, it's quite a story. Thank you, Melissa. The number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You know, Nathaniel, I wanted to ask you about the rest of the colonies. And I know this book is about New England, but several times you do make mention of how people outside of New England felt about these rabble-rousers in our region. They had some choice words even to describe people here. How did other leaders of the American Revolution, like George Washington, feel about us?
Yeah, well, it's very interesting. When George Washington arrives, he thinks he's going to find this, he's heard that this is the army that, if not, didn't win the Battle of Bunker Hill, fought nobly and bravely. And instead of being impressed, he's actually abhorred he abhors what he finds. You know, he came from Virginia, which was a hierarchical society. He comes to New England, and these are a bunch of soldiers who have grown up in town meetings. And when they're given orders, they don't do that. They say, "Well, we'll talk about it before we'll agree to do what the officer tells us to do." And he describes them as dirty, unkempt. And he was completely depressed by the prospect of trying to lead these people. This was a militia, group of militiamen who did not want to take orders, and Washington was trying to turn them into a professional army. And what you see is with Washington begins the greatest, most difficult work of nation building, where up until this point, each colony had had its own identity, even within New England. If you were from Massachusetts, you didn't necessarily like those from New Hampshire, and Connecticut was another story altogether. Even people from different towns distrusted one another. It was a very parochial, clannish kind of environment. And Washington was trying to make this group of parochial, very inward-looking people begin to think in terms of a national consciousness. And it would take him literally years to mold a truly professional Continental Army. But by doing this and sticking with it, Washington was creating the basis of what would eventually become the United States of America. And once again, we look to New England as, you know, the rabble-rousing patriots. But that's a very different set of mindset than what you need when it comes to building a nation. And Washington is the key transitional figure when it comes to that transition.
Well, when you read the descriptions, I mean, I laughed out loud, and you kind of have some sympathy for Washington and his generals.
Absolutely.
Trying to get these people together. I mean, here's the way one person described them: nothing but a drunken, canting, lying, praying, hypocritical rabble without order, subjection, discipline, or cleanliness, and must fall to pieces of itself in the course of 3 months. Wow.
Well, you know, and it was very close to doing exactly that. But Washington, by instituting all sorts of orders, and, you know, and one of the interesting things is there was an ancient tradition in Boston of called Pope Night on November 5th of every year, where it was their version of Guy Fawkes Day, in which rival gangs in Boston from the North End and the South End would have carts with effigies of the Pope and the devil. And it was the idea was to steal the other person's cart and beat up as many people as possible. And this was an annual, basically anti-Catholic celebration in Boston. And on November 5th of 1775, Washington is informed by his officers that they want to celebrate Pope Night. And he says, "Are you kidding? Here we are trying to get Catholic France to help us in this revolution. We're trying to get French Catholic Canada on our side. And you want to celebrate Pope Night?" And I think it's with those regulations in November 5th of 1775 that you can argue begins the process of the American colonies becoming a new nation, because Washington is saying, hey, we can no longer think the way we used to think. We now have to think of ourselves as a nation. We have to get outside of our old mindset. And that is a very interesting and difficult process, and it was Washington that was taking it to that new and truly higher level.
Well, and something else, though, General Washington's generals, although they had opinions about the New Englanders as a bunch of drunken revelers, later on they did come to respect these men, partly because, and I'd love to hear a little more on this, Nathaniel, partly because these guys were battle-hardened veterans. A lot of them came out of the French and Indian Wars that, you know, churned through New England, as you've written. Well, and they knew what they were doing when it came to
absolutely.
Fighting.
Absolutely. And, you know, and one of the leading officers is New Hampshire's own John Stark. You could argue that if it wasn't for John Stark, the Battle of Bunker Hill would have gone very badly for the Americans. He very late in the game, built a stone wall that stopped the British cold, and he would fight nobly at the Battle of Bennington and be there at Saratoga. And, you know, he was a fight, you know, he had grown up in the woods of New Hampshire, and had at one point been abducted by Indians, and he came from that ancient New England stock. And he had a set of talents that were absolutely required. And so what Washington had to do was create a professional army and yet provide an environment where someone like Stark, who never came into the fold when it came to this Continental Army, he was always doing it on his own terms. He was even squabbling with the legislature of New Hampshire. But, you know, that was part of America as well, you know, this rugged independence. And that was the great challenge, how to create a professional army and yet tap into this ability that is, you know, made of the wilderness, made of the beginnings, the messy, bloody beginnings of America. And it's a fascinating process.
Well, and there's so much more we could talk about, Nathaniel, and we've run almost out of time, but I did want to ask you one last question, if I could. Your publicists are making a big deal out of the fact that this book has been, in their words, optioned for a film by Ben Affleck and Warner Brothers. If you were, Nathaniel, invited to make a cameo appearance in this film, who would you be?
Oh, my goodness. Who would I be? I don't know. You know, I'm terrible at this kind of thing. Let's see.
There's so many great characters in this
book.
There
are so many great characters. I'd have to be a bit part. And let's see. Oh, man. I guess I'd like to be John Stark. That would be my fantasy. Yeah, because he comes in there. You know, he doesn't talk much, so I wouldn't have much dialogue. And I'd like to be John Stark.
And many decades later, you could say, live free or die. Right?
Right. Or don't fire till you see the whites of their eyes.
Well, Nathaniel, I got my fingers crossed for you. How about that?
Okay, thanks.
It's been great to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
That's Nathaniel Philbrick, award-winning author and historian. His other works include In the Heart of the Sea, Mayflower, and The Last Stand. The latest that we talked about, Bunker Hill, A City, A Siege, A Revolution. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our interns are Faith Meixel and Catherine Muzzy. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, an astronomy update with our Sky Guys. We'll examine some of the latest headlines from space science. There's a huge amount of excitement about the Comet of the Century coming this fall. Also, NASA's Mars rover Curiosity turns 1 year old, and mysterious geysers on one of Saturn's moons leads to speculation about the presence of water far out in space. Email us at nhpr.org and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
The Diane Rehm Show, next at 10 on NHPR, where we get support from UR members and from Seacoast Orthopedics and Sports Medicine in Summersworth, where Dr. Moby Parsons now offers the direct anterior approach for hip replacement surgery. More at sosmed.org. And Polar Caves in Rumney, a family adventure featuring self-guided cave tours, nature trails, animal exhibits, a mining expedition, and more. WhiteMountainsAttractions.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO, Concord, 89.1.
WEVS, Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH, Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN, Keene, 90.7.
WEVC, Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ, Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF, Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ, Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
Good morning. It's 10 o'clock.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. Yesterday's announcement that the Washington Post would be sold to Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos shocked the newspaper industry. The deal is the latest in a series of consolidations driven by a migration to online sources. Print news.